Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Religion at Work podcast with me, your host, Binna Khandola. In this series, we've been shedding light on different religious practices and how religion relates to the workplace, the legislation, and the wider economy. This month, I'm thrilled to be joined by two guests from the world of academia who are experts in their own right to examine the link between religion, politics, and wider society. Joining us from the University of Groningen is Erin Wilson, Professor of Politics and Religion and co-chair of the Advisory Council for the Transatlantic Policy Network for Religion and Diplomacy. And from the University of Goldsmiths is Chris Baker, Professor of Religion and Public Life and the Director of the William Temple Foundation, a research hub and think tank generating ideas about the impact of religion on civil society. Welcome to both Chris and Erin, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's lovely to see you. I'd love to see you both. Thank you for agreeing to do this. I know you're very busy, but it's a real honour to have you, the two of you here. How did you even get into the areas that you're working in?
Well, I think for me, I mean, I've had a lifelong interest in faith. I mean, I'm a person of faith myself. I'm Anglican, but I trained in theology, but then got quite bored with that because I was interested in kind of how the social, political manifestations of religion were emerging. And this was, you know, this is going back to the early 2000s. And I think there's a social cultural shift at that time, the new millennium, you know, the old secular kind of Cold War order modernist was collapsing. There was the revival of what Peter Berger calls furious religion in terms of things like, you know, the Islamic Revolution in the late 70s, the collapse of the Soviet Union, primarily through, you know, the work of Solidarity, which is a Catholic union in Poland, Lech Wałęsa and all that kind of stuff. And then obviously the new millennium started with a bang, literally, you know, unfortunately with the Twin Towers attack and the whole kind of rise of Islamist-based terrorism, you know, distorted very much the kind of, you could call a kind of progressive, you know, interdisciplinary discussion on religion and belief, but it certainly brought it back on the agenda. And I think for a lot of people, there was a realization that you can't bracket out religion and belief now from public life. And I was interested in how you bracket in religion and belief. So I talked about spiritual capital, and my first entree into it was looking at urban regeneration in Manchester in the early 2000s and comparing and contrasting what faith groups meant by regeneration and what urban planners meant by regeneration. But often juxtaposing those two, because in areas of high deprivation, the faith communities are often the only ones left standing, and they were regenerating their communities. So that kind of really got me interested in this whole interface between religious belief and public action, and how religion is often an invisible, but increasingly a more visible actor in how we create solidarity and resilience. Obviously, it can be used and exploited for regressive ends, but, you know, the media tend to focus on that. I think I feel duty-bound to talk a more positive vision about the role of religion and belief. And basically since then, you know, we've had the whole growth interest in spirituality and search for authenticity and meaning post-COVID, cost of living crisis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we're at an interesting point in human civilization where I think that there's a collapse in trust in various secular modernist narratives, but no one's quite sure what's going to fill the vacuum. And I think it's going to be an interesting mixture of different ontologies and epistemologies. That's what I'm interested in. Good. So it's a very long-winded answer.
No, it was fascinating. Yeah, how about you, Erin?
So similarly, I grew up in a Christian household. I've had a kind of long and variegated faith journey since then, and I would eschew any kind of label at the moment. But when I was also very interested in issues around human rights and global justice as a teenager. And when I went to university, I started studying politics. And I did this subject called Politics of Nonviolent Change. And we were studying people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And I knew about them, and I knew that religion had inspired their political philosophies. But we were not talking about that during the course at all. And I just found that really interesting. So I asked my tutor, why aren't we talking about this? And he said, I don't know, but that's a good topic for your essay. So I wrote my essay for, I think it was a second year politics subject on that, and then did my honours thesis looking at the relationship between religion and violence. And that was actually the year of 9/11. So when 9/11 happened, I was finishing my honours degree and doing my thesis on religion and violence. And then the following year started my PhD, which was looking at the relationship between religion and foreign policy. And I think the thing I've always been interested in, I guess Chris and I intersect here, the thing that I've always been interested in is inequalities of power and how those power relationships get defined and who gets to decide who's in and who's out. And when you come to religion, I think that's one of the, I mean, Vinny, you mentioned this right at the beginning of the call. I think it's one of the areas that is least focused on because there's this assumption that everyone knows what we mean by religion. But that's actually not true. We've all got very different ideas about what religion is. And as well as that, we have quite biased assumptions about what religion is and what it means when someone says that they are religious. And there are also hierarchies of religions in politics and society that I think then get played out in the workplace as well. But we're often not aware of those. We don't interrogate those enough. And we need to be more aware. Like there's the training that's done on unconscious bias these days needs to include unconscious bias around religion.
But
as well.
I agree.
Yeah. I think.
That's really interesting, actually, that the area you chose to study was the thing that you weren't taught. Isn't that great? That's a great thing about universities, isn't it?
It's kind of
you get taught stuff and you kind of think, actually, I'm interested in the thing you haven't talked about.
Yeah, exactly. Because as Chris was saying, you know, it's end of the Cold War. Everyone's kind of assuming, you know, secularization thesis, religion's done. We don't need to pay any attention to it. And then suddenly it's back. It never really went away, but everyone's like, it's back. And people don't know how to make sense of it anymore. And we're still kind of stuck in these very secular categories of how to make sense of religion. And we need to move away from that. So, and I think Chris is right when he talks about this, the different ontologies and epistemologies becoming more and more important.
Can you share examples of how religion and belief intersect with organisational policy, for example, in government, business, education?
Okay, well, I mean, I just picked an example from my own place of work. So I work at Goldsmiths University, University of London. And you know, interestingly, really, you know, Goldsmiths with its kind of tradition of a sort of Marxist, post-Marxist, secular, materialist kind of culture as a university located within a very diverse, religiously diverse, as well as ethnically and culturally diverse part of South East London, all parts of South East London. Therefore, what we know about religion in the UK is that it tends to coincide or tessellate very closely with diversity and poverty. So Goldsmiths almost, I wouldn't, it'd be too far to say Goldsmiths finds itself in a sea of religion, but there's a lot of religious minoritized, racialized and minorities living in the community, and lots of them are attending Goldsmiths. So there's a high visibility of religious students from religious faith backgrounds, particularly Muslim community, including Jewish communities as well, and Christian and others. So it's had to develop its own kind of response to that. And I'm a member of what it calls its Religion and Belief Working Group. We were set up about a year ago, and you know, there's a big list of things to do with it. We're not really there to advise. We're there to try and sort of keep an eye on what one might constitute best practice with regard to the way that universities work in relation to religion and belief. So, for example, exams and timetabling, making sure that exams don't fall, you know, intersect with the religious festivals and rites. Student societies and clubs, you know, how do students in societies and clubs welcome in relation to fixtures, dress? Obviously, food in canteens, halal kosher food, accommodation, single sex, halls of residence, alcohol, bars and events, you know, what's the policy on providing space for alcohol-free freshers events and that sort of thing. There's a long, long list. And I think what you could interpret that is this is Goldsmiths trying to kind of interpret its legal obligation to religion and belief students and staff members based on the Equalities Act. 2010, but since October the 7th, of course, that kind of what you might call tick boxing or technocratic approach to religion and belief has suddenly been just blown apart by the visceral impact that events in the Middle East have had on our campus, and particularly, you know, Muslim students and Jewish students. So we're now into a whole kind of different category of safety and free speech and you know, what does it mean to really exercise plurality, you know, tolerant, not just the tolerance, but you know, a kind of deep understanding of difference and otherness. So we're suddenly finding ourselves having to deal with issues that we didn't anticipate when we first set up.
Yeah. So it kind of covers everything.
Yes.
You know, so your working group is busy.
It is. Yes, it is busy, and busier than it thought it would be, and actually has acquired a more strategic importance for the senior management team, because they see, you know, like a lot of senior management teams, they're really struggling to know how to deal with this issue. And it's going to, you know, the legacy of it's going to be ongoing. And I think it's going to, you know, there are serious, I mean, people are going to have to take religion and belief much more seriously now anyway, post 7th of October.
Yeah. So you've done all of those things which you were talking about. It didn't sound tick boxy to me, but you know.
No, but I mean, it's a kind of, if you like, it's trying to interpret the letter of the law, if you like, in ways that are appropriate and sensitive. But I think what I'm trying to say is that what we're currently experiencing, you know, is the need to find a much deeper and more nuanced and sophisticated response to how religion and belief plays out in the public square.
And it goes from kind of looking at the way we operate at the university, and then you start actually, you know, starting to question what does free speech mean?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
What does dealing with difference mean? Actually, you said there's different levels.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, there's other things around faith-sensitive well-being services, faith-friendly student finance. Faith spaces, obviously, is a key area. You know, how does Goldsmiths provide faith spaces for people? You know, so it's a really big agenda.
Yeah. How about you, Erin?
Yeah, I think Chris's example points to a categorical distinction that I think we need to make when we start talking about religion in this kind of way. Like, how does religion and belief intersect with organizational policy? So on one level, we're looking at religion as understood as an individual's private personal beliefs, and how does an organization cater to that? Another way might be to understand religion as an actor or an institution that might have broader social, political, and cultural influence. And another one is as a form of community identity. And I think that's what we start to see in the examples that Chris has shared. We've got these different kinds of religion becoming very important in the way an institution or an organization functions, and how they manage the relationships that they have with students in this case, clients. Students are a form of clientele in some ways of thinking about higher education.
But those three categories that you add, your religion as an individual's private beliefs, an actual institution having political or social influence, and religion as an identity. Can you just expand what you mean by that?
I think when we talk about religion or belief in sort of organizational policy or the law, what we're thinking about is, how do we ensure someone's individual right to practice? How do we ensure someone's individual right to believe? But associated with that, you've got institutions that may or may not be formally recognized. So the Church of England, as an example, the Catholic Church, and other religions have, in at least in Euro-American contexts, have had to adopt this kind of hierarchical institutional structure. It's not necessarily something that they have had historically, but in order to have a direct relationship and communicate with government and claim their rights and their space for their practices, they've had to adopt this kind of institutional representation. So you have these institutions that also play a role politically and socially. They provide moral guidance. They also advocate for particular policies in certain ways. And then you also have these identities at play, which is very much what comes out in the aftermath of 7 October, I think, but also longer term, like if you think about the aftermath of 9/11. And there's a certain amount of, so because religion as an identity is entangled with all other kinds of social and political identities, because what it means to be a Muslim Palestinian is not the same thing as what it means to be a Muslim Pakistani, or what it means to be a Muslim Indonesian. What it means to be a Christian in England is very different from what it means to be a Christian in Nigeria. And I think those kinds of cultural nuances and political nuances, we don't pay sufficient enough attention to in the public sphere. And also when we're trying to think about how to manage relationships amongst individuals and communities within a setting like a university or a business.
That is just really interesting. I've never, what the two of you are talking about, I've never thought about before, actually. the different type when we talk about religion, what are we actually talking about? And I think Chris's example was going to actually, this is to enable an individual
exactly.
practice,
yeah.
and all of a sudden you need to an identity or different identities, and how the, and it's managing those that then becomes critical.
Yeah, it's managing those, and it's also making sure that the people around those communities have an appreciation of the differences and the nuances. So we take 7 October and its aftermath as the example. If we think particularly about Islamophobia and anti-Semitism that have been directed at people in the UK, in Europe, in Australia, United States, a lot of that has been done without an appreciation that just because you're Muslim, it doesn't mean you support Hamas. And just because you're Jewish, it doesn't mean you support the Israeli state. And so making sure that the broader community also understands those intricacies and the entanglements that are happening there, that helps you to protect those communities as well. I think all of this would fall under the broad category of what's termed religious literacy. And that, I think, is the thing that a lot of organisations need to be doing more of and better. And it's starting to be picked up by foreign ministries that I work with. They're starting to do some more training around this, but there's a lot of resistance to it. Also because, like, some of the questions that you raised, Binna, it's related to this. Like, there's still this, you know, don't talk about politics and religion. There's still this taboo around religion because it's seen as such a dangerous, controversial topic. But if you can sort of take it away from the realm of personal belief and identity and get it more into this kind of social and political phenomenon and understanding it in that sort of way, using that as the entry point and then allowing people to explore the identity and belief, individual belief aspects from there, I think that helps to take some of the heat out of it and make it more accessible.
Chris, you've written about spiritual capital theory. And I've come across, you know, various other kind of capital theories, like about human capital theory. What is spiritual capital theory?
Well, I'd like to answer that by picking up, in, I think, on what Erin, how the last point that Erin was making, really, which is the best way to, I think, to approach understanding religion belief is how it's lived out and how it's, if you like, I'm going to use a capitalist term, but how it's cashed out in the public square. So how are people acting in the public space, whether that's business, whether it's politics, whether it's community activism, whether it's whatever, how are their actions and their positionality in the public space influenced by their beliefs? And so that's what spiritual capital theory really does. It takes people's beliefs seriously and says, actually, and I talk about, you know, faith communities, but actually since I first started talking about this, you know, it's widened out into I think you can argue that spiritual capital is a resource that people of belief also have, because basically it refers to the kind of energizing capabilities of one's deepest beliefs. And the most people feel the need or the desire to live their lives in alignment with their deepest values and beliefs. It's what Aristotle called eudaimonic happiness. It's the life well lived. And therefore, I think spiritual capital theory allows you to kind of make some of those traces and those kind of connections more visible, because actually, you know, a lot of people just sort of get on with it. A lot of people are very happy to sort of, you know, do incredible things quietly and unobtrusively because, you know, because the ethical imperative from their beliefs. But I think, you know, it doesn't do any harm now to actually be more explicit about that and to see it as a resource that needs to be nurtured and valued and respected. And I think, you know, we're coming back to this full circle thing. I think you detoxify and you kind of take the heat out of a lot of anxiety people have about religion. If you just talk about, well, religious people have beliefs which clearly shape what they do. They build, you know, those beliefs are, I mean, from my definition of spiritual capital, embeds those individual motivations within what religious communities offer you, which is a community and a kind of ritual and a sense of belonging and a sense of being accountable for the way you live your life. Very famous American sociologist Robert Putnam talks about faith groups as being very good at what he calls moral freighting, i.e. carrying their morals or freighting their morals into the public space. So that for me, so I'm interested, I'm fascinated in how, and again, to use a slightly rather maybe obscure theory, I'm sort of influenced a lot by Bruno Latour and his actor network theory. So how does religion and belief as an actor, as an actant, shape the public space, whatever that public space is, but equally, how does the public space shape and influence belief? And so for me, it's a dialectical process, it's a dialogical process, and it's infinitely complex.
Did Robert Putnam write a book called Bowling Alone?
He did, yes. The book I'm the moral freighting quote comes from a book called American Grace, where he looks at the impact of American communities on the faith, on politics. And interestingly, again picking up what Erin said earlier, actually in America and to some extent, you know, in the UK, it's religious institutions are very much shaping the way that political institutions act. And the basic model of political institution in the US is the congregation. Mm. Unfortunately, other faith groups like Buddhists and Muslims and Jewish people have to kind of fit into that kind of notion that they are kind of like a Christian congregation. But the congregational model of activism and engagement and politics is integral to the way, you know, American politics is shaped, and to some extent, you know, and when the British government goes to other faith communities, they're expecting to find the equivalent of a vicar, you know, somebody who kind of represents the community and can speak on behalf of a wider group. And again, that's disastrous, frankly. Yeah. You know, we do need much more literacy around that. But I mean, that's the default model that most Western European countries work with when they think about faith.
Yeah. And I think you've written about that in Australia. I think I've come across stuff that you've written, Erin, about Australia, about there's kind of this Christian framework and other faiths to kind of fit that model, which is kind of understandable, but it's a bias, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a very famous case in the 1990s involving the Indigenous people in South Australia. Yeah. And they were against having a bridge built from the mainland across to an island, claiming that the island was sacred for Indigenous women. And they couldn't share what went on the island because it was only for women to know about it, and only for certain women within that Indigenous tribe. And there were various different royal commissions and into the issue. And it was always brought back to this question of, does this count as belief? Does it count as legitimate? And it was always, this is something that Winifred Fowler Sullivan writes about as well, but often it gets left up to the individual judge to determine whether something is a belief or not, and whether it is essential to quote unquote core religious practice or not. And that's quite problematic when you have these different frameworks coming up against each other. And I wanted to also pick up on something that Chris was talking about as well, in terms of these shifting kind of labels and like the way that how people identify and mobilize their beliefs in public is constantly changing. And that's something that I don't think we've caught up with in a lot of academia. Mm-hmm. And certainly not in terms of public policy. So if you look at something like a census will ask people to tick a box in terms of their religious identity. There's a movement called the Emerging Church Movement that sociologists have been studying for over a decade now. It's broadly Christian, but it is about kind of reimagining Christianity following sort of disillusionment with traditional church and a period of deconstruction and sort of decolonial critique of dominant Christianity in a lot of ways. And one of the things that defines people within this movement is that they don't want to be labeled. They don't want to identify with any particular brand of Christianity or, you know, have that label put on them. And so when it comes to filling in a census, which box do they tick? A lot of them will end up ticking none because they don't want to identify or be counted as Christian because of the dominant associations with what Christianity means or what that implies about their values. And those, because Christianity, religion in general, but I think Christianity in particular, is often associated with quite conservative values around sexuality and gender equality. And so for people who don't want to be identified, don't want their faith to be identified with those particular values, they would rather be identified as members of the nuns group than as members of the Christian group. But that doesn't give us if you just then look at numbers and categories, it doesn't give us an accurate depiction of what's actually happening on the ground. So this, anthropologists call it the lived religion approach, which is exactly what Chris is talking about, studying how people live out their daily lives and where how they understand what religion is, how they understand what their faith is a much more, I think, accurate and beneficial way of interrogating this issue than coming at it with these sort of top-down approaches of, well, this is religion and this isn't. Mm. And that then also feeds into how we make policy as well, I think, or how we should make policy.
Both of you make me reflect on different things, actually. Chris, I did this piece of work with leaders. I interviewed about 30-plus leaders, and they're very senior. And I was asking them what were the key moments in their lives. So I wasn't asking them, you know, how are you now, and give some advice on how to be a leader, but what were the key turning points in your career, key moments in your life, which made you the leader you are now? And I was actually quite surprised how many people, and it was well over half, there's about 33 people, it was well over half, but maybe two-thirds actually, maybe more than that, said actually that it was their religious upbringing which informed the way they behaved and the decisions they made. And they all, I think everybody was at pains to tell me, though, I'm not religious, but my upbringing as a Hindu, as a Jew, as a Sikh, as a Christian, those values actually are part of me, and that's why I do this. And they were all people I'd met and who I kind of admired and had some time for. But it's really interesting you're saying, actually, that the way that this guides people's lives, and they do it quietly. And then that also links into what Aaron said. I think this is what you're saying, Aaron, and actually that you just live your life out in a particular way.
Yeah. But I also think it's a reflection of widespread implicit secularist biases around religion in society, so these assumptions that religious people are conservative, that they're often irrational, they're backwards, they're very traditional, and people don't necessarily want to be associated with those, or they're bigoted, they're intolerant, people don't want to be associated with those kinds of values. And so that's the side of it that has to be addressed as well, is debunking some of these assumptions. I mean, it's not to say that there aren't religious people who are conservative and, you know, dogmatic and don't trust science and all of that sort of thing. But you find those people in other areas of life as well. So this idea that religion is the problem has to be debunked, and we have to get people to think more critically and self-reflexively about their own biases.
Yeah, and that's what came out of the research, actually. The people, I think it was interesting, because I kind of thought that Christians would have a more positive experience in the workplace than people of other faiths. And in terms of taking days off for religious reasons, obviously that's kind of in the holiday system, so they didn't experience that. But everything else they did experience. So the distinction that kind of emerged for me was between believers and non-believers, as opposed to, you know, things of individual faith. In your opinion, what are some of the challenges that organisations face in seeking to accommodate diverse religious beliefs within their policies and practices?
Well, if I can start off on that one, I think a lot of it goes back to the conversation we've just been having, which is recognising the plurality of individuals and not pigeonholing them in very binary categories of either religious or secular. Most people are complexly both. And I think what's driving that is two things that I'm reading about a lot, which crop up a lot in the reading that I'm doing, particularly when you're talking about millennials and particularly post-millennials. One is the search for authenticity and the demand that my authentic self is recognized in the workplace. So if my authentic self is a religious identity or belief identity, actually, I'm not going to put up with any bullshit anymore about that. I'm going to be out and proud about it. And I think particularly, I mean, I know Aaron was talking, you were both talking about sort of, there's still a kind of suspicion and difficulty around religion. And of course there is. But I think if you're a younger generation and you have a belief identity, then you're quite upfront about it. And that's accepted, because it's accepted as part of this kind of wider search for authenticity and meaning. And the other key framework that I think fits into this is intersectionality. So as complex human beings of multiple identities, through intersectional theory, we now really understand how you've got to take all the kind of characteristics or facets of our identities into account, and to see the extent to which they both allow you to be subject to oppressive practices, discrimination on a particular part of your identity. But also I think it gives people, again, an insight into how complex most people really are, and therefore looked at as a positive tool for recruitment or something, or kind of development, you could say, well, intersectionality is a really important thing to honor and recognize. And I mean, in the early history of intersectionality theory. It was all about gender, you know, emerged out of Black feminist discourses. So it was about gender and race. But now it's including lots of other characteristics, including religion and belief. So religion and belief is now slowly working its way into the intersectionality debate. So therefore, I think, you know, that where there are challenges, where there are obstacles, it's because, as Erin was implying earlier, HR departments and maybe leadership of businesses hasn't caught up with this need to understand the power of authenticity and the power of intersectionality. And with that, of course, comes a co-created understanding of who we are as people in the workplace. So again, it's this kind of, I think if you take it seriously, then you're going to be much more relaxed about letting people voice, you know, who they are. Because actually, and I mean, you know, this does go to the kind of business argument, doesn't it? If people feel that they're being valued for who they are in the workplace, if they feel that they can be their authentic selves, they're going to be much more efficient, they're going to be much more innovative, they're going to, you know, there's going to be many more days they're not going to lose because of sickness. And therefore, it, you know, at a very basic level, it makes total economic sense. If you want to retain an innovative and, you know, effective workforce, and I know there's been a lot of research done on that from people like Deloitte saying that, you know, diversity and religious diversity is generally very good for company bottom lines.
Yeah, Erin, I wonder if you could just speak to this actually about this recognised religious plurality of individuals. People aren't either religious or secular, they could be both. What do you think about that?
No, absolutely. I mean, because just as there are different kinds of being religious, there are also different ways to be secular. And so you have quite assertive or aggressive secularists who are adamant that religion should be out of everything in the public sphere. And then you have what are termed kind of passive secularists who would say that religion is allowable within the public sphere, but within limits, and those limits are determined by the state. And so within that category, you can have, and there's multiple kind of variations within all of those as well. You can have people who agree that the state should have ultimate final say over what is allowed in the public sphere and what isn't, but who are also very religious and very pious in their own practices. So I think that's absolutely true, that people can be both religious and secular. And religion versus secular, they're not the only categories. Like, they are what Chris was mentioning earlier, they are categories within a broader kind of framework of ways of being, of ontologies. So you can choose to be secular in the world, or you can choose to be religious in the world, but they're not mutually exclusive. And I think just to kind of pick up on the question that you posed as well about challenges that organizations face, I do think this kind of lack of religious literacy and secular literacy, which can be brought into this, is a big problem. And we've talked about some of these problems already, but I would see the most significant problems with a lack of religious literacy is that we don't appreciate the complexity and the nuance. We're largely ignorant of the differences within and across different religions. And we struggle to make this distinction between individual belief and practice and the lived out experiences, and how that also intersects with politics and culture. And we're also not aware of our own biases. Yeah. And that means that we miss opportunities for collaboration in the workplace. As Chris was saying, and I completely agree, it means people can't be their authentic selves in the workplace. And so they're having to hide parts of themselves, and it limits their creativity. And I think we also miss implicit ways that people experience bias and discrimination that may not be due to the workplace, but are due to things happening outside the workplace that happen within politics and society. The impact of 7 October is kind of the classic, like the not a classic example, but a very real example of that. And that those kinds of intersectional relationships we need to be much more conscious of.
Yeah.
Can I just very quickly come in on that? So, I mean, just as an interesting example of what everyone was talking about, a couple of years ago, I met someone who defined themselves as a spiritual atheist. And then I discovered actually there's a whole network of people who, you know, global network of people who define themselves as spiritual atheists. So that's a very, just a very kind of stark kind of example, I think, the way that people are, you know, mixing and matching, you know, identities that would previously have been seen as very, needs to be very separate and very binary.
Yeah, I love hearing that. And I have no idea what that means. Back to your point, Erin, I don't, my mind isn't kind of flexible enough to kind of think, what the heck does that, you know, I can't understand it. So what does that mean?
Well, I think that means that we need to start by unlearning everything we think we know about religion. And I've written about it because I'm quite passionate about it. Like, the book was written because I saw a need, but also I just got deeply frustrated with having the same conversations with people, mostly within the foreign policy establishment, over and over again about the importance of taking religion into consideration. And we've been having these conversations for like 30 years or more, and we're not getting any further. And part of the problem is we're stuck in these very secular enlightenment ways of understanding what religion is. And until we get beyond that, we're not going to be able to grasp the fact that there are all of these nuances and complexities. If we can get people to a point of saying, this is what you think religion is, and here are, and this is what I've done in like training that I do with Defence Force personnel. Okay, here's what you think religion is. But what if I throw all of these questions at you? Like, you know, is religion a set of beliefs and principles by which people live out their lives? Does that mean that veganism or environmentalism could be considered a religion? Is it a community of people brought together around a shared belief in something greater than themselves? Could nationalism be considered a religion then? Like, there's all of these other examples that kind of fit these things that we think about what religion is, that then make us question this category and then make us go back to what Chris was saying and look at how are people themselves actually making sense of this? How is it affecting their lives and how they live their lives? And then from there, how do we as organizations, as governments, how do we make policy that allows people to be their authentic selves and allows us to create? And I think people should have ownership in that. So I think for organizations, I also think for governments, but people need to be part of that conversation. It shouldn't be a top-down policy that's imposed. In a workplace, people need to have ownership over those policies. And I also think having these conversations together. So one of the kinds of examples that comes up in this, or as I was reading the questions, one of the examples that occurred in my mind was a workplace situation where you have someone of a particular faith, let's say Christianity for now, for the sake of argument, who is very anti-LGBTQ. They don't agree with same-sex relationships and they want to be able to state that. Then you have someone who is also a Christian but who is openly gay. If you have a conversation about religious freedom and expression in a safe environment and where these people actually encounter one another and build relationship, because that is the key thing, I think. It's very easy to make statements about the other when you don't know them. But if you have, and then in that kind of an environment, from there, you start building out organizational policies and people have ownership over it and they're able to, and always the principles of dignity and respect are at the core.
Yeah. In that sense, I sometimes do think, and your work on communities, Chris, you can actually see that there are different communities lived in different parts of town, but the workplace is one space where people actually come together and we have to rub along with one another, don't we? So the workplace actually could be a real positive facilitator.
Yeah, and I think the workplace in many ways is a, you know, in terms of, you know, because I've looked at some big global private companies have a religion belief, and I look at something like the TUC, and I think, you know, the best practice can often lie within the business sector. And therefore, the challenge is how do you translate outscale some of the best practice from global, you know, firms who recognize they're global. Therefore, if 84% or whatever it is of the world's population affiliates to a religious identity, then that global market is deeply religious. They get that from a business point of view. But I am aware that, you know, for example, you know, other public sector institutions are not nearly as flexible and as nimble. I think for the reasons that Erin's outlined, there's something about the cohort of, you know, senior managements in civil service, in the health service, for example, still seem to be kind of, I would, you know, there would be two rooms, but I mean, basically they seem to be trapped in a kind of 20th century secularism and they haven't embraced the 21st century pluralism.
And what best practices have you seen, Chris?
Well, I've seen good practice. I wouldn't say necessarily best practice, but I mean, I've certainly seen a large global company with a very diverse workforce being very open and on top of understanding when religious festivals occur. And it's absolutely not a problem to allow, you know, Jewish employees to leave early on a Friday night, or to allow Muslim colleagues to pray five times a day. And the quid pro quo is, we respect your identity, and therefore we don't have to ask for your loyalty. It's baked in. You know, we know that that won't impinge on your effectiveness. And then another good way in which they do it is, if, so for example, Diwali, everybody celebrates Diwali, and the whole company celebrates Diwali, and that, you know, people from the Dharmic faith explain what Diwali is. And another example was, I suppose you'd call them affinity groups. So there was lots of opportunity for Christians to meet together, Jewish people to meet together, blah, blah, blah. But the only criteria was, these were not closed groups. They had to be open to anybody else to join. And they also had to put on events to which everyone else was invited. But there was a sense in which, you know, you could come together with people who understood immediately who you were as a Muslim, as a Christian. But then, you know, there was a real recognition. And that included belief as well. That included space for atheists, you know, on similar lines, humanists. And it seemed to be, you know, on the surface anyway, it seemed to produce a genuine kind of synergy between recognizing internal and cultural aspects and understanding the progressive and positive value of that to the wider business. It wasn't seen as a problem. It wasn't seen as a hindrance, as an obstacle. Yeah. It was actually seen as an asset that needed to be nurtured and yeah, was an asset for everybody.
Interesting. Yeah, well, I like that, actually, that you, anybody can attend, and you have to put public events on.
Yeah, they're not closed shops. Yes, and they would put things like, you know, please be aware when you do Friday night drinks of your Muslim colleagues. You know, can you occasionally do an event that doesn't automatically involve getting, you know, laddered at the pub on a Friday night? But yeah, are there other spaces, social events which are more inclusive? And the evidence was that people were more than happy to do that.
Yeah. How about you, Erin? What good or best practices have you seen?
Yeah, I had a similar reaction to Chris. That I'm not sure about best practices, but you know, better or worse practices. So I haven't done a lot of research on businesses as such. Most of my work's focused, as you know, on the political environment. One of the things that I've seen working with groups, well, religious groups where there are tensions, is, I guess this is similar in a way to the examples that Chris has shared, is that you bring people together around shared concerns and shared values, but you allow them to be their full authentic selves. So we did some research on this same topic of freedom of religion or belief in cross-cultural contexts, and groups from different religious traditions and communities were brought together around topics on education, access to education and healthcare, and, you know, things of shared concern. And as part of those activities, the organizations running them created explicit space for talking about religious identities and religious differences. And people, it broke down barriers and prejudices between the different groups about one another and about what it means to be Christian or to be Muslim in these examples. And it meant that then there was this sense of shared community created, and they worked together on different projects that helped the whole community. And they also learnt more about each other's faith traditions. And so I think that kind of principle can also be translated to a workplace, as long as, and this is what Chris has been saying, everyone is allowed to be their authentic selves. It has to be explicitly stated that it's okay for people to bring this part of themselves as well.
Yeah. I mean, October the 7th, has come up a couple of times now. And Chris, you seem to be saying earlier that the university has responded, and a lot of organisations kind of, they've been scratching their heads kind of and very concerned. What did you do in the university?
Well, I mean, it's a really difficult one, isn't it? So I think the main challenge is balancing the right to free speech with the right of students to feel safe on campus. And where that was most viscerally felt, I think, was that Jewish students just didn't feel safe on campus anymore. Because of the sort of, you know, the kind of the loudness and the sort of, you like, the sort of, you know, the kind of the way that other students were organizing clearly in support of Gaza and the ways in which that was being done. And so the university is really struggling to kind of, you know, make sure that the right to free speech is upheld. You know, people want to protest very vigorously for the rights of Palestinian people and an end to the, you know, calling for a ceasefire and so on and so forth, with the right for Jewish students and other students to go about their daily business in a you know, safe and productive way. And to be honest, that hasn't worked. I mean, I just don't think many Jewish students have been able to be on campus since really October 7th. And that's obviously going to have a huge impact on their well-being and their academic performance, as it does on lots of other people as well. So I don't think we've got it right at all. I mean, I'm not sure what right looks like.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's been occupations and so on, you know, of buildings in protests and that kind of thing. So it just feels like, yeah, I mean, who knows where this is, what will all end and how will all end. And the role of the chaplaincy, I'm not quite sure what role the chaplaincy has. One instinctively feels there's the need to create spaces of just silence and reflection, and where people can gather. But I'm not sure, and that would be partly, I think, my response to it is to create safe spaces for quiet gathering, silent gathering, and just light a candle, and you know, and ditto silent marches as well. But for some reason, they just don't seem to be. Flavor of the day.
For the future, looking to the future, what challenges and opportunities are there for organizations who will be managing these issues related to religion in the workplace?
I think the use as AI becomes more integrated within workplaces, I think that's going to be an issue, because the AI algorithms replicate all the biases that already exist within societies. So we're going to have to be aware of that when we make use of AI algorithms and, you know, things like ChatGPT and so on. The other thing for me that I think workplaces are going to have to grapple with, not just in terms of religion, but broader issues around identity politics, because I think identity politics is what is defining the 21st century at this point. And I think the challenge for a lot of workplaces may be to create these safe spaces where people can express their full identity and protect those safe spaces against potential political forces that may want to get rid of them. If we see the rise of national populism in a lot of places, I think that's something concerning to pay attention to, that those inclusive and diverse spaces within organizations can continue in spite of that. Just on the 7 October thing as well, I just wanted to share. So I give a lecture on religion and the international security environment for NATO Defence College every 6 months. And I had to give that lecture less than 2 weeks after October 7 last year. And I gave it again earlier this year, and there were people from the Israeli, Egyptian and Pakistani defence ministries in the audience. And one of the things that has resonated most with people in this, when we've had this opportunity to talk about it, is just remembering that this is two very traumatized groups of people, and historically, and there is in some ways a sense of intergenerational trauma taking place, and two traumatized peoples just re-traumatizing each other and bringing it back to that sense of humanity, and that both have been traumatized, and that plays a part intergenerationally and collectively, is something that I have found people to kind of stop and pause and go, okay. I mean, having the space to actually have that conversation in the first place is a luxury these days, because there's so much kind of noise, as Chris was saying as well. But that's one thing that I've found.
That is, I haven't heard anybody say that, but of course it is why wouldn't intergenerational trauma actually be part of what's going on?
Yeah. There's a book called Collective Trauma and International Relations by a guy called Adam Lerner that I haven't read all of, I've just read part of, but this is about politics now and not necessarily about organisations and workplaces, but I think paying attention to this sense of collective trauma is also something that could be relevant in workplaces as well, particularly after things like mergers or layoffs or,
Chris, finally with you, then, opportunities and challenges.
Well, I'm trying to be glass half full, so I'm going to talk about opportunities. I think a lot of the research I did recently was looking at not businesses, but the experience of the pandemic and how faith groups and local authorities came together to form very effective partnerships in the early days of the pandemic. And I think there were key lessons that were learned there about how you run businesses, how you run organizations, and how you handle diversity. And the three takeaways that I got from the research and from listening very closely to the experiences of those very innovative partnerships was it wouldn't have happened without, I'm not going to use a theological term here, without kenotic leadership. So kenosis is a Greek word that's often applied to passages in the New Testament which talk about Jesus's humanity and divinity, and that how Jesus, if you like, it means emptying, emptied himself of his divinity in order to become fully human. I think that's a rather unnuanced reading of the word kenosis. Other theologians have talked about it as making space, stepping aside. And that, I think, is my preferred understanding of kenotic leadership, is a leadership that's prepared to step aside and make space for other views and opinions without losing the leadership that's involved in curating those and seeking to understand them. So I think there are lots of good examples of kenotic leadership, both in the public and private sector. A post-millennial word is collab, collaboration. I think it seems to me, and I've got both my kids in their early 30s, it's a natural state of being to want to collaborate with other people, to find people that share similar passions and understandings. And then the digital becomes really important in that. The digital becomes a kind of gateway into collaborations across all sorts of different things, practical problem solving, but also, you know, critical theory and you know, very practical things. So organizations that foster collaboration and work with the grain of that natural collaboration, I think will do well in the future. And then you've mentioned it before, Erin, the importance of shared values. So let's talk about the values. Let's talk about the beliefs that shape us, that really inspire us and motivate us. And then surprise, surprise, we'll find that although people come from what appears to be very different ontologies and kind of understandings of the world and truth, actually what they're all united around a basic idea that, you know, human beings should be, you know, we should create spaces of human dignity and flourishing, both for the human and the non-human. And I think, you know, there's a huge overlap there of consensus around what makes a good business, what makes a good organization. It's an organization that allows that to happen.
That was genuinely mind-blowing. And there's all sorts of things there. I've kind of thought, wow, you've totally shifted my thinking. Thank you.
No, thank you for giving us the space.
Yeah, absolutely. And also thank you for giving attention to this issue in your podcast and in your research. As you said, like hardly anyone is paying attention to it. And I think it's so important. So, yeah, thank you for that. And thanks for the opportunity to be part of this conversation.
Thank you so much again to Erin and Chris for joining us and to you for listening, for what was an absolutely fascinating discussion about the role of religion in public life and civil affairs. I thought that was wonderful, and I got so much from that conversation, and I hope you did too. Join us again next time when we will be exploring how senior leaders approach religious expression in the workplace. Thank you so much.